This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's a big week for the Supreme Court. The court handed down a gun control decision today and is preparing to end its term. And Elena Kagan began her confirmation hearings today. We're going to look back on a momentous Supreme Court decision that remains controversial and continues to divide America. In January 1973, the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade ruled that the right to privacy protected a woman's decision, in consultation with her doctor, whether to carry a pregnancy to term. My guest, Linda Greenhouse, is the co-author, with Reva Siegel, of the new book Before Roe v. Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling. The book examines the arguments of abortion rights supporters and opponents in the years before Roe v. Wade, arguments made by women's groups, medical groups, religious groups, the courts, and others. And the book is filled with fascinating documents that illustrate how the debate was shaped. There are plenty of historic surprises. Linda Greenhouse covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times. She now writes an online law column for the Times and teaches at Yale. Linda Greenhouse, welcome back to Fresh Air.
One surprise to me in your book is that the medical community, which supported decriminalization of abortion at the time of Roe, a century earlier, had spurred the criminalization of abortion. In what ways did the medical community support criminalization of abortion?
Well, back in the 19th century, I think there were two things happening. One, of course, abortion was quite dangerous, so there was a public health concern about abortion. Any surgery was dangerous. They didn't have sterile technique. And so anytime any medical instruments were introduced into the body, the patient was in danger. And number two, abortions were typically performed by people who were not doctors. And so there was a bit of a competitive edge, or a kind of anti-competitive edge, you might say, to the medical profession's efforts, which succeeded in every state in the country, to make abortion a crime.
So what changed in the 1960s or early 70s that got the medical community, meaning in this case the AMA, on the side of limited legalization of abortion?
The medical impetus to start reforming the old abortion laws actually came not from the American Medical Association, but from the American Public Health Association, from the public health profession. There was a public health doctor, Mary Calderon, who was a medical director of Planned Parenthood and also very active in professional public health circles. And she wrote some influential articles depicting abortion as a serious public health issue, that is to say illegal abortion, back alley abortion, as a serious public health issue, and basically started calling on the medical profession to take a new look at this old issue. Abortion now could be a very safe medical procedure when done properly under the right conditions, so the facts on the ground had changed. Women were having illegal abortions in large numbers. There was a good deal of medical bad consequences and suffering because of this, and it was really the public health docs who sounded the call.
And there was also more, as you point out, there was also more ways of noticing high-risk pregnancies, and there was a lot of damage being done to fetuses through things like German measles and also thalidomide. Women were taking thalidomide before we knew that it caused terribly deformed babies to be born without arms or without legs. So what impact did that have on the medical profession?
Those two facts, the German measles epidemic in the 1960s, which was known to cause, German measles is known to cause serious defects in a fetus when a pregnant woman contracts German measles in the first trimester of pregnancy, and there was a big epidemic. And then this question of thalidomide, the Food and Drug Administration actually never admitted thalidomide into the country, but it was a commonly used sleeping aid in Europe. And babies all over Europe, it was discovered, were being born with the most devastating defects, basically lacking arms and legs. And we recount this in the book. We have a document, a narrative from a woman whose name is Sherry Chesson. Then she was Sherry Finkbein, Miss Sherry of Romper Room in Phoenix, Arizona in 1962. her husband had brought back a bottle of thalidomide, which he had gotten by prescription on a business trip in London. It wasn't very well known in the United States, but she took this. She was pregnant with a much-wanted baby. And she then read a little article in a newspaper about this thalidomide problem that was beginning to emerge in Europe. She called her doctor, and the doctor said, "Oh, good grief, I need to get you an abortion." Abortion in 1962 was illegal everywhere in the country, and it was illegal in Arizona except to save the life of the pregnant woman. And, of course, her life was not in danger. But she said, you know, people need to know about this. Other women are also in danger. And she allowed the word to get out, at which point the hospital said, "Oh, we can't give you an abortion now. This is all much too public." And she couldn't get an abortion anywhere in the United States. And she and her husband ended up going to Sweden, where she had an abortion. And this became a big national story. It was the cover of Life magazine. And inside the magazine were pictures of her, a very attractive young woman, and these devastated babies from Europe without arms and legs. And I remember, as a young teen, sitting in my living room at home reading this magazine with just amazement. I don't think I had ever heard the word abortion or the concept of abortion. I mean, back in the early 1960s, people didn't talk about it. It made a huge impression on me.
You know, on a related note, you know, we were talking about Jerry Finkbein, who had an abortion in Sweden because she couldn't get one in the United States after she found out that the thalidomide she was taking was likely to cause her baby to be born with horrible defects. On the other side of that same predicament, you reprint a letter by Dr. Jane Hodgson, who in 1970 performed an abortion on a 23-year-old patient who had German measles early in pregnancy, which would likely lead to the fetus being born with, you know, terrible physical problems. And the Minnesota law where she lived permitted abortion only to save a pregnant woman's life. And she writes, and you have the document in there, "I'm probably the only Mayo alumnus with the dubious distinction of having been arraigned and tried for committing a felony." And she refers to years of frustration in attempting to provide a high grade of medical care under an archaic and cruel law. Were there many other doctors who you found who felt very frustrated by their inability to perform abortions because of the law?
Yes, there were certainly doctors in the medical community who felt that as a medical service to women in enormous distress, this was something that they wanted to be able to do. Not many of them challenged the law openly, as Dr. Hodgson did. She was, as you mentioned, a Mayo Clinic-trained obstetrician and gynecologist in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and she did this very openly. She and her patient agreed that this would be a test case, and before performing the abortion, Dr. Hodgson went to federal court asking for an injunction, asking the federal court to strike down the Minnesota law. And when the court didn't respond and the pregnancy, of course, was advancing, she performed the abortion and then called the authorities and basically said, "Come and get me." And they came and got her, and they arrested her, and they charged her, and she was convicted, and she was sentenced. But the sentence was put on hold because Roe against Wade was then pending at the Supreme Court, and Roe against Wade was decided, and so obviously her sentence was never carried out.
One of the key phrases in the abortion debate became the right to choose, and or that evolved into choice, pro-choice. You have a document about the early use of that phrase, and this is a memorandum by Jimmy Kimmy, somebody who I'd never heard of before your book. Tell us who she is and what she did to develop that phrase, the right to choose.
Jimmy Kimmy was a young woman who was the executive director of an organization called the Association for the Study of Abortion, ASA, which was one of the early reform groups and was migrating in the early 70s from a position of reforming the existing abortion laws to the outright repeal of existing abortion laws. And she wrote a memorandum framing the issue of how the pro-repeal position should be described. And this is what she wrote to her own staff as they were trying to frame a kind of a public relations position. She said, "The alternative seemed to be freedom of conscience and right to choose. I hope someone can think of a clearly better one, but in the meantime, let me say why I think the latter preferable. There are two reasons. The first superficial, the second less so. Right to life is short, catchy, composed of monosyllabic words and important consideration in English. We need something comparable. Right to choose would seem to do the job. Second, more important, is the fact that conscience is an internal matter, while choice has to do with action, and it's action we are concerned with."
That's really interesting. And so that evolved into pro-choice?
Yes, right to choose, pro-choice. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say she was the only one who was coming up with this, but it was an interesting document to find, and the earliest that I did find that showed how the dialogue was evolving in that pre-Roe period.
Another, I think, interesting document that you reprint in the anti-abortion side is written by Dr. J.C. Wilkie and his wife. He was a gynecologist. She was a nurse. They had done a lot of, like, abstinence kind of work. And in 1971, they co-wrote a handbook on abortion. Tell us a little bit about their significance.
Right. Dr. Jack Wilkie is a key figure in the Right to Life movement. He and his wife self-published this little book called Handbook on Abortion in 1971. It's in the form of questions and answers about abortion from the Right to Life point of view. And it got distributed like wildfire. It now exists in many, many editions. People can go on Google or Amazon and find it easily and translated in many languages, and it really became a Bible of the Right to Life movement. And we were grateful to Dr. Wilkie for giving us permission to republish it. One reason we wanted to have a substantial excerpt from it is that people on the pro-choice side have never seen it, and it's a very striking document, and his voice was and continues to be an important voice on that side.
One of the things I found most fascinating about this was what he wrote about rape and incest. And can I just read you an excerpt and tell me what you know about this? One of the questions is pregnancy from rape very common? And the answer is, no, it is extremely rare. Question, why is this so? Answer, if a girl is raped or subjected to incestuous intercourse and reports the fact promptly, she's usually taken immediately for medical attention. This consists of a douche, commonly a scraping of the uterus, and at times doses of medication, one or all of which, while done partially to prevent venereal disease, will almost invariably prevent her from getting pregnant. If the rape victim would report her assault properly, there would be, for all practical purposes, no pregnancies from rape.
Right. What I think he's reflecting there is a fear that women would seek abortions. If there was a rape exception to an abortion prohibition, women would seek abortions by saying they've been raped, whether they had been raped or not. That's how I understand that passage.
But he's basically describing a DNC here, scraping of the uterus.
Yes, I guess depending on how quickly the woman presented herself for for medical attention. If it's right away, there would not have been implantation in the uterus, and so what we would think of as a pregnancy wouldn't have begun.
One of the interesting things I find about this handbook on abortion is the Wilkie's attempt to deal with rape and incest. And one of the questions is, what is meant by the difficulty of proving rape? And then the next question is, you know, a lot of people say, but think of the poor girl. And they write, true, if in fact she was actually raped against her will. As everyone knows, there are many degrees of resistance or consent on the part of a woman to the act of intercourse. It is easy for a woman rejected by a lover to then accuse him of raping her. For any kind of justice, some type of proof must be asked. Question, what of incest? Incest is intercourse by a father with his daughter, uncle with niece, etc. The same dynamics mentioned above apply. Will Uncle John admit to having relations with his niece? Never. It would be her word against his. The court might even believe her, but could not act on it legally, incestuous intercourse is seldom reported, and when pregnancy does occur, it is not usually reported as being from incest. So he's totally dismissing the idea of rape or incest as being a cause for abortion legally.
Right. I read this as a response to the reform talk that was in the air before Roe against Wade, and some states had begun to legislatively act on it, that there should be a set of exceptions to the blanket prohibition, and rape and incest were among the exceptions that legislatures were considering. And this kind of language in Dr. Wilkie's handbook on abortion is a pushback against that.
The feminist movement, of course, was a very potent part of the abortion debate. And you describe how the feminist movement reframed the terms of the debate. What are some of the things that the feminist movement introduced, new ways of thinking, new concepts that the feminist movement introduced into the abortion debate?
The role of the feminist movement was actually one of the surprises that we found in researching the book. It's natural to think of the cause of abortion reform as having been part and parcel, part of the second wave feminism of the 1960s. And actually, that was not originally the case. It was, as we discussed earlier, originally an issue that was put forward by the public health community. The feminist community at that time in the mid-60s was much more interested in empowering women to take a full place in the economy, in the workplace. So things like childcare, things like equal pay. And there wasn't much talk about abortion reform in feminist circles until quite late in the 60s when Betty Friedan, in a very influential speech, drew the connection between the ability of women to participate fully in the economy and the ability of women to control their reproductive lives. That then began a reframing in feminist terms of the issue of abortion reform as part of women's empowerment, part of women assuming a new role in society. And this in turn, of course, created concern among those who at the same time were concerned about the debate that was going on over whether to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And the cause of abortion reform became caught up in the cultural shifts and the cultural struggles of the late 60s and early 70s. By the time the cases about abortion, challenging the old abortion laws, started filling up the legal pipeline and making their way to the court, the issue was no longer simply an issue of public health.
Well, you write about how abortion became a part not only of the culture war but of the political debate. And you say that abortion enters the political arena during the Nixon administration with the help of then Republican strategist Kevin Phillips. What did Phillips do to bring the abortion debate into the Republican Party?
Kevin Phillips and his sidekick as a political strategist, Patrick Buchanan, perceived as they were working on President Nixon's 1972 reelection campaign, perceived the role that abortion reform was coming to play in social and political discourse out in the country. And there was an opportunity that they saw for political realignment. It's very interesting that going into that period, when you look at the polling, the notion of repealing the old criminal abortion laws had majority support among actually all demographics in the country, but more Republicans than Democrats identified themselves as being for abortion reform. So here was an opportunity to peel some Democratic voters, mostly urban, ethnic, Catholic Democratic voters, away from the Democratic Party, attract them to the Republican cause if President Nixon could identify with the cause of preserving the criminalization of abortion, as he then started to do. So this became the basis for running with the abortion issue and trying to peel away Democratic voters and beginning the party realignment that didn't really come to fruition until the late 1970s with the rise of Ronald Reagan.
So when the Supreme Court finally handed down its decision in Roe v. Wade in 1973, giving women a constitutional right to abortion, what were some of the arguments the court seemed to take to heart and other arguments it seemed to ignore in its final decision?
Well, it's interesting. If somebody reads Roe against Wade, and people typically don't, they'll find that it talks mostly about the rights of doctors to act in what the doctors think is the best interest of their patients without facing criminal liability. The voices of women are quite absent from Roe. And on the other side, on the dissenting side, the voices on behalf of the unborn are quite absent from Roe. The dissent is basically aiming its displeasure at what the two justices who dissented, Justice White and Justice Rehnquist, characterized as the judicial activism of the decision. So the actual decision reflected only a slice of the arguments that were swirling around this debate, and we excerpt the briefs and excerpt the friend of the court brief so that readers can see what was actually being presented to the court and contrast it with what the court actually did.
So exactly what right to abortion did Roe v. Wade give women?
Roe, the Supreme Court in Roe against Wade gave women the right to decide to terminate a pregnancy in the first trimester without any interference by the government. In the second trimester, under government regulations that could be adopted only for the purpose of protecting health and safety. And in the third trimester, after viability, the state could prohibit abortion with an exception for a woman's health. That was built into the two decisions that the court issued on January 22, 1973, Roe against Wade and Doe against Bolton.
And since the Roe v. Wade decision, women's right to abortion has been narrowed by congressional legislation and state laws. So the arena has changed a little bit, and the right to abortion has been restricted in some ways.
What's changed in the years since Roe are the procedural obstacles that the Supreme Court has allowed states to place in the way of women exercising the right to abortion. So, for instance, waiting periods have been upheld. Notice to parents has been upheld for teenagers seeking abortions. Those kinds of regulations, and there are new regulations coming down the pike that may reach the Supreme Court in the foreseeable future. But the basic right to abortion, the ability of a woman to decide to terminate a pregnancy, has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court, 1992, Planned Parenthood against Casey. And so that right does still exist.
What are the new challenges to abortion that you expect to come to the Supreme Court in the near future?
A few legislatures have passed statutes that seek to discourage women from going ahead with the abortion by requiring doctors to either show the woman an ultrasound, to perform an ultrasound and show the image to the woman, or if the woman declines to look at the image, the doctor is required by law to read her a description of what would be seen on the screen. And this has been put forward as an effort to inform the woman. What it actually is an effort to make the decision to go ahead with the abortion emotionally fraught and onerous. And so these are inevitably going to be challenged. And the current Supreme Court standard for evaluating a restriction on the right to abortion is the undue burden standard, whether the regulation at issue places an undue burden on a woman's right on the exercise of a woman's right to abortion. And so this kind of legislation will be tested against that standard.
Linda Greenhouse, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Linda Greenhouse is the co-author of the new book, Before Roe v. Wade. You can read the book's introduction on our website, freshair.npr.org. Greenhouse is a former New York Times Supreme Court reporter and now writes an online law column for the Times. I had the chance to talk with Senator Robert Byrd in 2004 about his life. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of that interview. Byrd died at 3 a.m. at the age of 92. He'd been in failing health. During the health care debate, he was brought into the Senate in his wheelchair to cast his vote. Byrd was a Democrat from West Virginia who served in the Senate for 51 years and in the House for 6, making him the longest-serving member of the Senate and of Congress. In the Senate, he'd served as majority and minority leader and president pro tem. I spoke with him when his book, Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency, was published. It was about his opposition to the Bush administration. Before the U.S. began to bomb Iraq, Byrd made a now famous speech in which he criticized the Bush administration for embarking on the first test of a revolutionary doctrine of preemptive war. He criticized his fellow senators for being ominously, dreadfully silent. No debate, no discussion. In your now famous speech of February 12, 2003, about 35 days before we bombed Iraq, you called President Bush reckless and arrogant, and you criticized your fellow senators. You said, "We stand passively mute in the U.S. Senate, paralyzed by our uncertainty, seemingly stunned by the sheer turmoil of events." This speech appeared on many internet sites. It was translated into many different languages. Even for people who weren't necessarily paying that much attention to your career, you became famous. What difference do you think this speech actually made in the Senate?
And I'm not sure that I could measure that. I thought that it's something that I felt strongly. I was astonished to see a Senate, which I have long, long come to revere, stand mute. The men who were there and the one woman who was there when I came to the Senate would not have stood still. How changed the Senate was, how intimidated the members were, how afraid they were, many of them, of being called unpatriotic if they didn't support the commander-in-chief.
Now, you had been concerned that by giving the president authority to launch a preemptive attack on a sovereign nation, that it would redefine the nature of defense and reinterpret the Constitution to suit the will of the executive branch. Do you feel like we've set that precedent now?
Yes. Oh, yes. But we've got to get back from that. We've got to withdraw from that foolish moment and the foolish act that we did. We've got to take that power back from the president. You see, the framers wrote the Constitution, and when they gave to the Congress the power to declare war, they were giving to the Congress the power to declare war, and they were not thinking in terms of one person or even one body. It takes two bodies, the House and the Senate, to declare war, and it takes many people. And here we were, acquiescing to an administration that doesn't really understand the role of the Senate, and we were shifting to one man, this awesome power. And then we were relegating to ourselves the position of doing nothing. We relegated ourselves to the sidelines, and that's where we are today.
On March 18, 2003, you said this on the subject of a preemptive attack on Iraq. You said, "I have urged the president to step back and reconsider his decisions, but the administration has its eyes shut, its ears covered, and its mind closed." What are some examples of how you think the administration closed its mind?
It doesn't listen. It doesn't listen to Congress. It looks upon the Congress with disdain. It just pains me that here's an administration that doesn't seem to understand the Constitution. It doesn't understand that the Constitution is we, the people of the United States. It doesn't understand that preamble. And some examples? Well, one example would be the creating of the Department of Homeland Security. It was hatched out in the bowels of the White House by four men, especially. Tom Ridge, fine man, former governor of the state of Pennsylvania. He was one. Another was the chief counsel, a man by the name of Gonzalez. Another was the head of the Office of Management and Budget. And the final one was the man who's down at the White House, the head of staff, Andrew Card. Those four hatched this idea, and the Congress wasn't counseled, wasn't asking the questions.
I know you voted in favor of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized the president to use force to repel armed attack and prevent further aggression in Vietnam. My understanding is that you came to regret that vote.
I do regret that, and Senator Morris, who was one of the two, the other one was Ernest Greening of Alaska, Senator Morris said that we would live to regret our vote. We have. I regretted my vote. But let me say this about that. We were misled by an administration. We've been misled in this instance when the President of the United States and there were super hawks around him brought us into this war, which should never have been fought. But let's go back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. One thing about that, it had a sunset provision which allowed the Congress in a concurrent resolution which did not have to go to the President and did not have to be signed by the President, could sunset that provision. In this case, in the resolution that was passed on October 11, 2002, there's no provision to sunset the action. I said, look, if we're going to be fools enough to shift this power to one man, to a president of the United States, and George Bush in particular, we ought to at least sunset it. I couldn't believe it that the Senate was willing not only to give this power to the president, but also to leave it there.
You've criticized the Senate for becoming the errand boy of the White House.
Yes.
Does the Bush administration interact with the Senate any differently than the other 10 presidents that you've worked with in your years?
I think that the Bush administration expects every Republican senator to toe the mark. And I feel that the unwritten rule on the other side of the aisle, as I've observed it, I think that they feel that the first thing, the last thing, and the thing to do always is to support the president. And they speak the words, commander-in-chief, as though they were those words were sacred. And it saddens me when a political party follows a president as though he were the king. And I've said from time to time, the commander-in-chief, why? The commander, there was a commander-in-chief in the Civil War in England, and Charles I used that term in 1639. The term commander-in-chief, that's nothing new. That term did not originate with the framers in Philadelphia. It's meant to indicate that the civilian, that the military is under the civilian rule. That's what it's there for. It's not some sacred thing that has some innate power within itself. But on these days, my friends across the aisle use that term, the commander-in-chief. Well, he's not the commander-in-chief of the Senate. He's not the commander-in-chief of industry in this country. He is the civilian authority who is over the military. That's it. So that back to your question, yes, the Republicans follow the commander-in-chief come hell or high water, it seems to me, and they all stand in line. I've never seen anything like it.
Is this true of Democrats and Republicans?
Well, it's true of Republicans, but it has not always been true of Republicans. I think of men like George Aiken and Norris Cotton and Everett Dirksen. These were men who stood on their own, and if it meant that they would break with the president, they did so.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2001, you were president pro tem, and you were third in line of success in the presidency. What was your reaction when you learned that after September 11th, the Bush administration activated what you've described as a shadow government of about 100 senior executive branch officials to live and work secretly outside Washington in a system reportedly run by the White House?
Well, I was surprised that I had not been contacted by the White House or by the administration. This was typical of the Bush administration. Here they were now. They created a shadow government. They didn't let the president pro tem of the Senate do anything about it. I read about it in the newspaper. This is typical of the administration. It is secretive. It likes to operate out of the White House. I don't think it understands the role of the legislative branch under the Constitution. The sovereignty rests with the people of the United States. And that's why this administration has left the Constitution. It has left the people, and it's driven by an urge to acquire more power.
Senator Byrd, I'd like to talk a little bit about your life. I know that your mother died in 1918 during the flu epidemic, and then you were basically adopted by, I believe it was an aunt and uncle.
My mother died on Armistice Day, 1918. I lacked a few days being 1 year old. Before my mother died, in anticipation that she might not recover from the flu, she asked my father to, if she didn't recover, to give the baby, quote, end quote. I was the baby. I had three older brothers and a sister. I was the baby. And it was her wish that the Byrds, one of my father's sisters and her husband, take me and raise me. And so on the night of Armistice Day, my mother went to heaven. And it is because of her wish that I'm a senator today. My mother's prayer, my mother's wish was that I be something. She said I was going to be the president of the United States. And she died. I know that her prayers have followed me. Now, the people who took me, they were good people. The man who took me was named Titus Dalton Byrd, B-Y-R-D, and he married one of my natural father's sisters. Her name was Valerma, and I was given the name of Robert Carlyle Byrd by them. And I've met kings and shahs and presidents and governors, and the greatest man I've ever met was that man who raised me, Titus Dalton Byrd. He was poor, but he was honest.
Now, you grew up during the Depression. Early in your, teenage years and early adult life, you made a living in a number of different ways. You were a gas station attendant. You were a welder. You ran a store. You owned a store, actually, with your wife. Then you went to law school and then first ran for the State House in West Virginia, then for Congress, then for Senate.
Yes.
I believe it
yes.
was early in your political career that you briefly joined the Ku Klux Klan. Now, most people know that that was a brief part of your history. Why did you join?
I joined for a number of reasons. In that day and time, things were different than they are now. There was a time when Mr. Byrd who raised me joined the Klan, and in those days, many of the upstanding men and women in the communities, I'm told, was told then, were members, lawyers, judges, bankers, and others were in the Klan. And so I joined it. I've regretted that. I've apologized for it. There's nothing more I can do, except I speak plainly when I condemn the Klan and its tactics. I've, I think, improved and grown since that time. And I would say, I would urge young men not to join the Klan. But I've always been so sorry that I joined the Klan.
You know, you've been talking earlier about how divisive America is and how disappointed you are in the Senate for not speaking up and acting independently of the president's wishes. But when you flip back to this period of America, and are we talking about the 1950s? 40s?
1940s.
1940s. I mean, to think that a young congressman like yourself felt that it was an important part.
No. I was not a congressman when I joined. This was before I got into politics.
This is when you were in business?
Well, no, I wasn't
even
in business.
That?
I was a meat cutter. I was a meat cutter. You see, at first I started out, as you say, in the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was a produce salesman. Then I was a meat cutter. All this was in the coal camps in southern West Virginia, where the atmosphere was southern, where we had many of the people who boarded at my mom's house. I call my aunt my mom. I never knew any other mother but this woman. She never kissed me in my life, but she was stern, very religious, and she didn't wear it on her sleeve. She didn't go around condemning other people and wearing religion on her sleeve, but she was a great woman. And so times were different then, but I was not in Congress at that time. My having erred by joining the Ku Klux Klan had long been publicized during the campaigns when I ran for Congress. But I didn't join the Klan when I was in Congress.
Finally, as a lot of our listeners know, in addition to having served in the Senate for many years, you have also fiddled for many years. You love bluegrass music. And you recorded an album in 1978 that we have a copy of. And I'd like to end with some music from that recording. Is there a track from the album that you recorded in 1978 that you'd like us to close with? Do you have a favorite track?
There's More Pretty Girls Than One on there. I think that'd be good.
Okay.
Yes, and I hope that my wife's listening. We've been married, 67 years. I love her. And I'd like to send this to her, if I might have that privilege.
Of course. So you're dedicating this one to your wife?
Yes.
Absolutely. Senator Byrd, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Robert Byrd died at 3 a.m. at the age of 92. Our interview was recorded in 2004. His wife, Irma Ora Byrd, died in 2006.
There's more pretty girls than one. There's more pretty girls than one. Every town I ramble round, there's more pretty girls than one.
You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Little girl, you turned me down. You left me all alone. So I'm leaving. song to sing when I am gone. There's more pretty girls than one. There's more pretty girls than one. Every town I ramble round, there's more pretty girls than one. Look down that lonesome road, hang down your little hand.